just start off, thank you so much on a Saturday morning as the conference is on its last day for choosing to spend a little time with us. We're happy to see you here. So start off, let's let you know a little bit who's here. So this is us, or Bitemoji versions of us. I'm Michael Hansen. I'm the Director of Library Technical Services at our institution. We are at a university, Sam Houston State University. Don't let that scare you off. We think there's a lot of applicability in our presentation at school libraries, but got to be honest where we're from. I'll let my colleagues introduce themselves.
We'll do it manga style, and you can go next.
That's manga right. Manga.
Yes, he's going to correct us constantly. I'm Ashley Crane. I'm actually the education librarian at Sam Houston State University, which means I work with all of our educator preparatory programs and administrator preparatory programs. So it's really my lifeblood. I was a K-8 teacher in Texas prior to becoming a librarian.
There it is. I'd wait for it to come to life. And I'm Heather Ader. I'm the instruction librarian, children's literature librarian, and I'm also our library science department librarian, so I support our master's program in library science, and we only produce school librarians through that program. But I also come from a K-12 background as a teacher, school librarian, and administrator.
So that's who we are. And we'd like to know a little bit about who you are. So,
Ashley's going. So if you would, with your hand, tell us who's in the room. If you're a K through 5 teacher, give us a 1. If you're a 6-8, give us a 2. 9-12-3. If you're a campus administrator, 4. District librarian, 5. If you're something else, give us a 0. Awesome.
All right. It's a little bit of everything.
Awesome. Does some of our others want to tell us what you are or where you're from?
I'm from Greece, Tennessee. I am our special education instructional coach.
Excellent.
But I work kind of like as a district-wide administrator for special ed.
Welcome.
Okay. I'm one of the others. I'm a pre-K-12 librarian at a rural public school in Northwestern, Maine.
Awesome. Very cool. You have a big reach. Awesome.
So I'm
full-time on
the 7th through 4th grade librarian. I'm the only certified librarian in my district, and I'm also an instructor at
IU.
Excellent.
There's another one there.
Go ahead. I'm one of those retired.
Awesome.
And for 10 years, but a very small rural district couldn't find anybody. And so I asked if I would come back for 1 year, and this is my 4th year.
Oh. Awesome.
So, the way it goes in our field.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Well, kudos to you. Sticking it out.
Well, I'll say this is my first AASL, and I'm just amazed. And so, what? I honor you so much for all that you're doing for our little ones, and taking what we teach, but also setting up our eventual students to come back and see us. So we appreciate that. All right. So for me, this next slide is the slide that I just envision you all get up and walk out of the room. Please don't do that. But we do want to give you the context for where we're coming from with some of our what we're going to talk about afterwards, which is, I think, much more pertinent. But we are a mid-sized university, 21,000 students. We have, I mean, you probably remember, 4-story library, 1.4 million items, which is actually extremely large for an institution our size. Our collection's old. I got there in 2016, and they hadn't weeded it for 40 years. So, right, and in your libraries, you're rotating fairly quickly, right? Because you need to stay current. Some no, some yes.
Mm-hmm. It takes money.
Right, absolutely.
And
yeah, oh, that's unfortunate. And you know, that affects us as well. But anyway, it's the first time I've heard this in this conference. We're at Library Congress, though our children's literature section is in Dewey. Mm-hmm. And we have centralized cataloging, meaning that we have a cataloging department downstairs. One of the things I'm amazed with, so many of you, is you're doing all of it. You're cataloging, you're doing the outreach, you're doing everything. And then, as I mentioned, it was spread across floors. To give a little context, though, to what these two will be highlighting a lot, though, is our education and our children's lit collection come up to 57,000 titles, 27,000 of which are picture books and children's books. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of our context.
Going along with that, Heather and I are both fairly new to our university. I also came in 2016, but in December of 2016, and Heather came in 2018, right? And so when we came, the education and children's collection, well, primarily education collection, hadn't been touched in 5 years, right? So we had a trickle of new things in, but we didn't have that kind of pedagogical base that we would expect our pre-service teachers to be using. So we started dreaming about what our perfect collection would be. What would it do? And so we have a couple of hopes for it.
So as we started that process, so Ashley preceded me by a bit, and I had come straight from K-12. So I'd done teaching, and then I'd done central office, and then I had gone back to be a school librarian, and then I went to administration, and then I went back to teaching, and now I'm at a university. But throughout my entire pathway in K-12, my relationship with my librarian, or as a librarian, my relationship with my teachers was crucial. But I also was charged at one point in time with the new teachers, so those first through 3 years, to make sure that they made it past year three and stayed in the profession. And I knew that even with those newbies to the field, I needed to talk about how important their relationship was with their school librarian. So we wanted to model that and develop that partnership with our College of Ed professors, as well as with our pre-service teachers, our students, so that they understood that that relationship held power for them in the classroom and for their students. So that was one of our hopes.
We also wanted to make sure our pre-service educators had that support. I'm actually a failed classroom teacher. I was one that didn't survive past 3 years. I mean, I found a different classroom in the library, so I still consider myself an educator. But I really only stayed in that elementary middle grades for about 2 years. And so I wanted to make sure that we had a collection that they would be, that they could see in their own school, right? So we have been building that kind of collection that will support them in those first 3 years, that they have the stuff, that they've been exposed to survival guides and lesson plan guides and curriculum before they ever step foot in a classroom. And part of that is supporting their pedagogical design capacity, their ability to learn and grow and be able to build lessons. And I felt, as a failure, that if I had known that there were all of these rich resources out there that had lesson plans already, that were vetted, that experienced teachers and librarians had written, that I would have been a lot more successful. So that was one of my goals. I want to make sure that those pre-service teachers are prepared to be those facilitators of knowledge.
And part of that, too, is that we actually wanted to model what their future school library would look like. So like Michael mentioned, the children's collection is in Dewey. It will always
she hopes I let no.
always be in Dewey, only because that's the model that we know in K-12, right? And I wanted to mirror that.
I have no plans to take it out of Dewey. No,
but we've had rigorous conversations about that, and decided that that is the best interest of the collection and our patrons that use that collection. So that was the other part, is we wanted them to see what a children's collection or a school library collection is going to look like. And throughout the course of this project, I don't know about you, but in my school library, behind the circulation desk or in the media closet or whatever, I had a small professional collection, which is exactly like Ashley had talked about. You know, those materials that helped with lesson planning or how do I handle classroom management or whatever. So we wanted to kind of embody that in what we were doing because we knew there was a disconnect. And part of that, too, was aligning everything to the standards and to the curricula. And this took, Ashley started this before I got there. But when I looked at the children's collection, I also want to make sure that I have nonfiction and fiction resources that are reflecting our state standards, our national standards, AASL standards, our accreditation, because of course the school is accredited. All of that was part of the conversation too. My collection dates back to the 1800s. What do I do with those? But I also have researchers in children's lit, so I can't get rid of my old 1800 only copy, you know, one of five in the country, whatever. I have to keep those. But I have to make sure that my current resources for my students and for Ashley's students are up to date. So if they're going to build a lesson, it needs to be current. Poor Pluto. I have to decide what to do with Pluto, right? Yes. You know? Scenarios kind of along that line. Is this me? So, mic comes back on. There it is. We've kind of gauged in previous sessions your comfort level with doing turn-in talks. So we're going to ask you just to think for a few moments about when you imagine a library collection, whatever that is, what do you see? And what do you hope for? So just kind of picture that for a moment. So do you have it in mind? One or two people, would you like to share? Yes, ma'am.
When I imagine a library collection, the first thing I think of is well-organized, like library shelves. I work in an elementary school, so of course I have an abundance of set of picture books. So I learned it's not just enough just to alphabetize them. You have to take, like, for instance, you have everything, the author's last name is A, then you have to break it down from there. Like, if the last name I said was like Adams, it'd be like A, B, going all the way down instead of Anderson, having to break it down. So that way it's easier to keep track of everything. Because that's what my students do. They'll take them, that looks neat. Then they'll put the way over on the other itself. So it's easier for me. And also when the teacher comes in and asks me, you know, do you have this, do you have that? It's much easier and less time-consuming to go down and know where it's supposed to be. And if not, look two or three shelves and set over.
Exactly. So well-organized, easy to find items in the collection.
I think for me, I'm on the opposite end of K-12. I'm in the high school. But well-balanced between nonfiction and fiction. And that balance could mean you have more of one, but it's still balanced that way or whatever. But balanced with ideas and perspectives as well. And I'm glad you said something about the 1800s, because sometimes that is worth having older copies of things, for, you know, depending on the topic it is.
Right. So a balanced collection, fiction, nonfiction? I think I saw your hand.
I see a collection that is very inclusive. We have the largest Arabic population in our state at my school.
Interesting.
And making sure that they see themselves and their classmates see them, like, you know, as a priority lottery.
So a diverse collection that your patrons, your students, can see themselves in the items that are in the collection, which is important in a diverse collection, right? One more.
So for me, I have a hope for my collection, and my hope is that students would be able to come in and not just only find their diary for the one kid that they love, but be able to expand. I don't know if it's based on signage or whatever, but if I like this and I like that, I would like them to be able to sort of grow and find things in unexpected places that appeal to them.
So a collection that's accessible, and they can find read-alikes or things that pique their interest. One more, and we'll have three more thinks, so we'll have more time.
I so appreciate what everybody said. I would add to that a balance of print and digital. I just was able to do a new collection for our high school, and 90% of the materials are digital and print, and so we expand our access to 20%.
Yes, so a balanced collection with digital and print to provide that 24/7 accessibility. And we will do our best, caveat, to repeat your statements because the session is recorded and there's no audience mic. So for the benefit of those that are listening after the fact, we'll try to represent that.
Okay, so now we have our hopes and dreams, but we can't make those happen and we don't know what's there, right? So that's what we started to do, is trying to discover what exists. First step was curriculum mapping, coursework analysis. We did a bunch of, we're a university and we're public, so they have to submit their syllabi every year. So we pulled a bunch of those and threw a lot of time and effort, papers on the floor, figured out what classes needed us most and what they needed from us. So not only defining the need, but what is actually in the collection. And we met with many of our faculty. Again, remember, the education faculty had been pretty much left on their own for about 5 years. They were begging for library support. And so we had several conversations with associate deans and instructors in our various programs, literacy, science and social studies, teaching methods, all of these different types of departments, to get their perspective. What is not working about our library? What would their hopes and dreams be for the library? We actually have a satellite campus where you can do the undergraduate teaching track completely separate from the main campus, and we do not have a library there. So that is part of our concern, is how do we make sure that our pre-service teachers at both places are getting what they need? And we did several other things.
So one thing that I was involved with is a big collection assessment project. As you saw, we had a large collection and we need to right size that. But in this context, we provided a tool where they got to go through their collections and decide what do we keep, what do we not. And then they, of course, then turned it around and began to use that tool to assess in this context as well.
And part of our fact-finding in this process was to figure out what is our demographic, and Ashley knows these numbers off the top of her head better than I do, and to give you some backstory, we ended up having to write a proposal before we could even launch this project. It's 26 pages. So we had to do a little background work. But like student population data, that would be the same as you knowing who's on your campus. So you know you have a large Arabic population, or what their test scores are, what they're tested on, where they land as far as their demographics are concerned, as well as what are your standards? What is your state telling you you have to teach? Or your district? What are they using in their campus improvement plan or as campus goals? So having a picture a picture of what of all of that looks like was part of the fact finding before we could actually push go.
Wait for my mic to come on. But to go along with that, we also had to know what the research said, right? We want to be research-based. And so what we found, again, we're talking about pre-service educators. They aren't your typical searchers, right? They're not going to go to a catalog and type in a subject term and expect to get something back. They're going to, if they do that, they'll pull one title and they'll go to the shelf and touch. So we found out in the research that came before us that pre-service educators primarily are browsers, right? We talked about earlier that there are four floors of our library. Previously to this project, our children's collection was located on the third floor, and all of the education texts were on the fourth floor. So our browsers were never getting up to the fourth floor. They stayed in children's, and that's all they knew. So in our proposal, we decided we needed to pull out all of those practical texts and co-locate them with our children's books so that our educators were actually going to get that school library reflected, but also that it would meet their searching needs. They were going to be better able to locate those materials that were meaningful to them. And we had to keep them in LC for reasons, mostly so we didn't tick off people.
Their perspective.
Sorry, we like to harp on him.
I'm the big bad administrator in all this, if you can't tell.
So we have another think for you. what information or data could or does inform your decision making? What drives it? Yes, ma'am, go ahead.
I've been living in Asia for the last 10 years, and the schools I worked in have had very old libraries. And so I look at usage data if I can, but really, the best thing I can do is go over to the shelves and demonstrate the amount of dust on the top of the book when it's time to say, listen, I really want to put new books here. And I mean, culturally, it was really difficult to try and get around that. It is a, stockpiling information is pushing. But a lot of it is the use and show, oh my gosh, you have kids. They're coming in and they're just sitting here. Let's get something so that they can get it in their hands.
Definitely. Age of the collection is a huge thing, and usage data, which, thanks to our lovely administrator and his collection assessment tool, we were able to do. So it's very valuable if you can pull that data, whether you have Follett or
Mackin. Right, yeah, pick a tool. I loved my Follett Destiny, but I became a school librarian and was using an older version of Follett, and Destiny came on board while I was a librarian. But our tool, which I think Michael will mention, at some point, provided the same. We just had to go through Michael to get the data. Whereas you can just, open up Follett or Mackin or whatever, and it's at your fingertips.
Would anybody else like to share? In the black shirt.
Yeah, so I use a lot of feedback from my students on this. For example, we genrefied our fiction section a couple years ago based on student feedback, which I think a lot of people have probably done. And now we're in the place of looking at how we could do something similar with our nonfiction section. I'm in Seattle, and Dewey's, there are some issues with Dewey just in terms of cultural responsiveness. So that's a more creative thinking process that will be ongoing.
I can't help but say LC2. Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, these systems were done in the mid-19th century. There are the issues.
But yes, using student feedback and information, that's an excellent thing. I wish we had been able to do that. Anybody else? Go ahead.
I was going to say, I do rely heavily a bit on student feedback. Usually one of the first things at the beginning of the year, make a big PowerPoint presentation. They might, these are some of the books I'm thinking about, what students expect. Would you read this, would you not? Because ultimately, if they're not going to read it, not worth up the money and the time it takes to bring it up to school. But due to the COVID-19, I've kind of had to adjust to the reality of the situation. Things that were beyond our control. And for us in elementary, it's really impacted their reading skills. I have students, their reading skills are literally set a year behind. So because of that, I've had to concentrate on ordering things that were closer to kindergarten, first grade reading level, to help them rebuild their reading skills before we can get them up to that grade level. Now, of course, I ordered several chapter books of that as well, but I had to make that a priority this year, getting things that were lower and ordering more than I probably would have otherwise. It's the world we live in.
Absolutely, and being responsive to those needs is incredibly important. And if you have the data points, definitely. Go ahead.
I came in late, and I apologize for that, but we use standards to inform our decision-making. So when we're talking about curriculum connections, I have to use the standards. If I'm gonna spend money on books, I have to make sure that it connects to the standards that our teachers are using in classrooms.
Definitely. Absolutely. That was a big part of what we did in our project as well. But we had to look outside our own state. We are Texas. Texas likes to educate its own educators and ignore everybody else. But that said, we're seeing things in our program change. They're really focused on adding the ITSE standards in, which relate to our Texas technology standards. But we have to add in those different types of standards to be aware of what they actually mean, right? Okay, so we'll move on. Is that one? Oh, yes, it's the big bad administrator.
Oh, I'm the obstacle. That's right.
You're the obstacle.
No, I do have to push back against that a little
it's
bit.
Not.
But
he really
you know,
isn't.
We did support this idea, and we wanted to do it. But the reality in an institution our size, we have the labor cut up the way it does. And so in some ways, I'm envious of you because you have the dexterity that you can make a decision, and if you get the right support behind it, you can move to do it, whereas we have to work with our various systems. But, you know, we did, for example, have to have a concession where we would continue to have the Library of Congress on the teacher instruction material because this it had implications in interlibrary loan, in our records we were getting from various vendors. So, but that being said, we did come down and did some crafting and some work locally to be able to shelve these things together in a place and make them more discoverable as we co-locate them. So, you know, you can get through them, but we all know we have to negotiate sometimes with the other needs of the institution. And yeah, sometimes you have people who are just not comfortable with things, and I don't know what to say beyond that other than in our instance, I think most folks who had concerns at the beginning have come around as they've seen the benefits. And again, you need your as you go out and try to build relationships with your administrators and get their support, then sometimes they can use their position to say, all right, we're going to take this chance, regardless of some of the concerns. We're not ignoring the concerns. We'll watch those and try and mitigate those, but let's take the chance and do the project.
And part of that, and you know this just as well, that when you're trying to launch something new, you have to have that support group that's behind you because they're going to help you along the way. So whatever that support system is, whether it's a fellow librarian across campus or somebody that's in your professional learning network remotely, because that is on the rise during COVID, the team that you work with, if you're blessed enough to have a staff member or a library aide or a para in your library with you or that works closely with you, if they aren't on board doing anything that involves change like genreification, which I did to my collection, when I was a middle school librarian, and that was new, like really new. How dare you do that? And I opened the school too. So I opened the school brand new collection and then decided a couple years later, why don't we just change the whole fiction section? But I had to have cheerleaders in my corner. And whoever your stakeholders are, community, students, parents, teachers, your campus administrator, and there's been so many conversations during the conference about that relationship between you and your administrators that if your administrator doesn't understand the what and why and how, you need them. If you suddenly make a change in your library or your ELAR teachers and you make this change, it's like now you have to backtrack and explain the why, right? So if that's part of your core group at the very beginning, it makes a huge difference, and the mountain does not seem as insurmountable, right?
Absolutely, and your cheerleaders help with that. Those people that are willing to be your advocates and so cheer you along the way. For us, this was our faculty members, right? So our teachers that were actually doing coursework and seeing the same needs we were. And then our instructional partners, which at the college level might be our associate deans who are building, supervising curriculum of these different coursework. But in your school, it might be the reading instructional coach, right? It might be a school counselor who's seen a need for bibliotherapy in support of this incident, right? Or this ongoing theme within your school. So look to those before you start a change, right? See if you can find somebody who's going to stick with you, going to cheer you on, because sometimes it will seem like a deep, dark pit that you just can't overcome. But if you have those cheerleaders in your corner, not only are they going to support you, but they're going to make their feelings known to the administration, right? Heather mentioned our proposal, which was 26 letters, or 26 pages long, included three letters of support from associate deans in our College of Ed. So that helped push some of our administrators over the hill, because if an associate dean somewhere else says, we need this, we must need this, right? And then we had our guinea pigs. We had to have some of those faculty that were willing to let us bring them into the new space and try it out. We're instruction librarians as well. So that means we want our classes to come and interact with us and interact with the collection. But in this new project change, and we hadn't had them come for so long, that we needed a couple that were willing to step out of the box and let us try. And so it's helpful to identify those as well.
And then we cover our advocates as well. We have one that we co-teach part of her class with her also, and she's great because she then posts it on social media. Because, you know, in some places, if it didn't show up on social media, it didn't happen. So she's really good about putting that out there, and I think she's now one of
the coordinators.
The coordinator for literacy or something like that, in a new position for her. So she puts it on her page and on the literacy page. So I'm like, we needed that PR, so we aren't very good about doing it ourselves. So.
All right, so we want to take one more moment to give you a chance to think, and then we'd love to hear from you who your potential or current advocates or cheerleaders are. So take a moment to think. So does anyone want to share?
Parents, like, I have the only reason I was able to actually lead this library and day team that I was working with, which was so horrifically old. Like, I've had books from the 1950s about geology, and I couldn't convince one of the admin, like, we shouldn't have this in our library anymore. but I had a parent volunteer who would come in, and she was helping me catalog Chinese library books. And so she became the biggest advocate for, oh my gosh, we need to get rid of these old things so we can make way for new things. And I thought that was so helpful. She paved the way so that I could actually do it. And like, they fought me tooth and nail for like a full year, even though I was there to build a new library for them. And then by the time after I was leaving after 2 years, I still get calls from them about how they appreciate it. So, like, you know, you're never going to win over everyone all the time. But.
Right. I can only imagine how valuable parents are. And in some ways, I imagine in some circumstances, I see on the news, parents might be a challenge. But at the same time, what a wonderful resource. Not necessarily open to us very often. I don't have too many parents coming in and advocating for us. So I would think parents are a wonderful cheerleader.
We're very fortunate in Tuscaloosa that our, at least I'm not sure, my principal and our district level administrators are all extremely supportive of the library. They've given us considerable funds the past couple of years. I'm giving $50,000 for my school this year for library books. And they have made that a priority, and it shows up in how our kids are reacting in the library.
Absolutely, yes. Having supportive administrators in all administrative positions are absolutely key. Yes?
I was just thinking, some of my guinea pigs can then become some of my cheerleaders. So inviting some of the, like, I'm going to work with some of the social studies, U.S. history teachers this next week. And I'm hoping that turns into a cheerleading type thing. Like you were saying, they would then post or start sharing, hey, we did this, and another teacher.
So treat your guinea pigs well. So they come back. Yes.
I've recently taken over for a librarian who left during COVID. And so we've had teachers that we've collaborated with like for years, and I wanted to kind of switch with a research project and kind of change it up a little bit. I was so worried that they were going to be like, no, we've done this forever, I'm fine with it. But they were like, yeah, let's change it up, that's perfectly fine, let's do it. And I was so excited, like, and they were so willing to change it up, and I was like,
okay, cool, like, yeah, let's do it. And so just having them be so flexible and then being excited and willing to talk about it to other teachers and new teachers as well.
No, that's great to use your teachers. It resonates with us because we too go into departments and the teacher will say, well, your predecessor did this for all these years. But so getting those few teachers will say, but yeah, let's change it up and see. Very important.
For us, we really capitalize on community partnerships.
Mm.
A lot of them have money that they're just willing to give away. You just got to ask for it.
Yeah.
So just explaining to them like where we stand, what we need, and then why we need it. And then getting our students to advocate for that. You know, we do meetings all the time where we're bringing in the mayor. Local colleges, they're helping us out a ton with resources and loaning us things and giving us things and buying us things. So just being willing to like step out there and ask. When you're just saying, hey, this is where we have, this is what we need, this is where we want to go with it. I mean, they're coming in and teaching classes for us. I mean, there are resources out there that are just waiting.
Absolutely, and very important to step out to the broader community because there are, still find a lot of advocates for the library. We just got to uncover them sometimes.
And I will take all the parent volunteers. Every year when schools open and the parents come with the children to school, I've asked for time. And so I let them know I only need 20 and these times, and we started to, because we needed to be open after school,
mm-hmm.
and many of in the rural community, the Wi-Fi doesn't get to where these people live,
mm-hmm.
and that was our first thing, to be open after school, and we needed the parent volunteers for that. That went into getting a better facility at the high school, because it was terrible. If it was those parent volunteers that spoke at the school board meeting, they're still very involved. And it depends on what they want to do. If they say, I want to be at the circulation desk, and I like checking books out, then that's fine. Some are like, no, I am majorly concerned about this collection. It's a mess, and they just like the shelves. And it's amazing when you can pair up. And we'll get 20, 30, 40 parent volunteers every year. And it's just, you know, trying to figure out what fits for them. Some love reading stories. So that I'm able to be more into the classroom and teaching and everything else that we do, but we don't have time to do. Because some of us are literally shelving books.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's like takes up so much time. So I really, the parent volunteers are good, but every year I get bad.
Right. Yeah. Now you get parent volunteers. Last one here.
That's such a cool thing that you got the parent volunteers, but then they became advocates for the high school group.
Yes.
So I think another cheerleaders would be the other, you know, working with my elementary or junior high to then work together or work, you know.
I have a vision much broader than just your institution.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to hop along here.
Okay, so how did we implement this 26-page plan after we'd done all of the groundwork? And you know, sometimes there's instances where you want to exact change and you have to have a few difficult conversations along the way. But everything we do in education has got to be data-driven or, you know, research-based or whatever the current terminology is for the same beast that we've been calling it forever. So we developed a data-driven action plan, and you saw the steps that we've used leading up to that, right? We presented it to our administration team, and they went through it, and we presented to them, and then we presented in smaller groups, and then kind of started moving forward. So when it says beginning the co-location project, that is us, Ashley and I, physically went to the stacks, the shelves on the fourth floor, and looked at what was living in the education section, as well as every other discipline A to Z in the building, except for M, because music,
yeah, music
lives
has
in the music library. And we don't touch the music library because...
Special.
It's special. We'll just leave it there. It's in a great place. It needs to be there. So we actually started the physical process, and he can run reports for us all day long, but we needed to touch the books, look at the books. We had in mind certain criteria. It is only... actionable items, not theory. So lesson plans, classroom management, assessments. How do I do this? How do I do that? But not the theory behind it. We'll leave that for our grad students and our PhD and EDD students up where it lived. So we've started that process. We've hit some bumps in the road, like COVID. So we're only about halfway, if that, through the collection. So you saw the numbers on how large the collection is, so it's taking a little bit of time. And yes, we could have just run it straight off of a report and done it, but we needed touch and feel and go through that process. Then it goes downstairs to Michael's department, and they relabel, recatalog, do all that stuff. Then we needed to identify what we know is missing. We're very intentional about adding K-12 textbooks because an education student needs to see what's in the textbook, student edition and teacher edition, as well as what, you know, the pedagogy says in a reference source or a professional title, and the children's book that could go with it. So we needed to kind of identify where those gaps were, and really slow buying state-approved textbooks in Texas is a very slow, expensive process. So we have to plan that out. We were supposed to have it complete in 3 years. You know, the last 20 months have been kind of weird, right?
And as a part of our proposal, we were asking for budget to do this. So that was another hurdle. It's like, we need $6,000 to start making this happen. So while we were moving stuff we already had, we're still buying new stuff because in Texas, EC has changed to include infant-toddler. And all of our curriculums on infant-toddler are from the 80s. Right? So these are things that I'm also trying to build as we are co-locating. And we hadn't had textbooks in quite some time. In fact, our collection development policy at the time said we do not collect textbooks. So we had to go in to change a major policy.
Change that.
And we're not buying class sets. We just want one state-approved sixth grade science textbook, yeah. Teacher edition and student edition, right? It's not much. But when you think about, we're talking specials, so music, PE, health, business, career and technology, all of it. It really, and ESL. So it really starts spanning quite a bit, right? And then we started sharing the story about this is available, and we started attending events. So we'll talk more about that in a minute.
Right, so Heather would give us this quote fairly often that, you know, we planned the work. You kind of see what we had the plan. They began working the work, and that was a great quote. But then we discovered the reality of another quote. I don't know if you're familiar with this one, but from Mike Tyson, everybody has a plan until they're punched in the face. So like you, I imagine we had two punches. One we knew was coming and the other one we didn't. Our building was renovated, yay. Also yay because we get to feature this new collection in a new space. And so we started our demolition for our renovation in February of 2020. And I remember I was chair of faculty senate at the time, and I had some people who was like, oh, there's this, you know, disease in China. You know, do we need to be worried about it? And I'm thinking, I remember SARS and H1N1. I'm not sure that we need to. And yeah, so our renovation that was supposed to take 5 months is going on 19 months. No small part due to supply chain problems. So anyway, so we have these slides in there mostly because we had hoped to bring you wonderful statistics and show you, you know, the back end of how this has worked. But instead, we're not quite knocked out by Mr. Tyson, but it's been a challenge.
Luckily, we started telling the story as soon as we started implementing the change. So we have developed additional advocates and cheerleaders over time because we've been able to tell our story to our stakeholders. And that started with faculty meetings and staff meetings to an extent. But we started in the library. We actually are a part of a team of 11 librarians that cover every subject taught at our university. And so while I select only for education, I have to ask permission from everybody else to move their books. So that became How do we develop the process? What are you comfortable with? Eventually, we want you to start purchasing for this collection so I don't have to. So we started having those conversations, and it's sparked some thinking in our library. But we also went to our College of Ed, where we had had faculty discussions before. Those were with our known users, right? But this one, we got invited by the dean to come and talk to the entire College of Ed, which is 150 faculty members, not including adjuncts. So we got to talk to all of them, and afterwards, we had so many faculty members come up and say, this is so great. We needed this. We had some historic members that said, we used to have this, and instruction has changed dramatically since it went away. So we're trying to bring back what they knew was successful in the past. And then we went to our student groups. We have a collegiate chapter of the Texas Future Educators Association. So we went to go talk to them to see, get the word out in our students about how they could use this and get some ideas on how they thought they could use it in coursework. And then we went to our College of Ed ambassadors, which go to high schools to recruit students. And they started sharing that information as well because it helps build the breadth of what we can offer to those incoming students. We wrote in our College of Ed newsletter to make sure anybody who wasn't at the faculty meeting heard about us. And what we were doing, we did several iterations of that. And we actually wrote a piece for the ACRL EBSS section, which for college librarians, the Association of College and Research Libraries, the Education Behavioral Sciences section. So we got to promote this not only amongst our own librarians and faculty staff, but we got to push it out to other education librarians who these sort of collections are starting to go away, and they're trying to figure out how to keep them, right, and keep them motivated and valued. And the fact that we were bringing it back helped show that there's value in these sorts of collections. So by promoting it more widely, we were getting more support, not only from inside, but outside the institution. We invited our faculty to visit, whether that was dropped by my office or, well, let's meet at Starbucks, because we have a Starbucks in our lobby. And we'll go tour it, or bring your class anytime. And we actually got more invitations to teach. We probably doubled our teaching in that one semester we were actually able to do it face-to-face in the 3 years preceding that I had been teaching with them. I actually got invited to be a guest lecturer in all 8 sections of the very first education class they have to take. So that was a major win for me. Yay. You get to meet your librarian as soon as you enter the college. So yay. And then it actually sparked grant opportunities. We had faculty members asking us to come and work with them on grants. So that was really a neat win for us. And that project has taken a really long time too. But we finally closed it out. So we're doing good. So we have our last thing for you. How could or are you telling your story to your stakeholders? Yes, ma'am.
So I'm at a new school this year, but prior to that, I would send out a newsletter with things that were happening, certain stats, but also ways I was collaborating. And I would, the things I wanted teachers to pay attention to, I would say, if you can answer these 5 questions from the newsletter, you get a prize. And then the questions were based on things that I really wanted them to see or know. And a teacher will come for a prize, candy, I'll come cover your class, whatever. And that was really helpful in getting them to pay attention to what I wanted them to.
Right, so not only exposing your stats, but getting them to interact. And I heard in another session, bribery always works. So yes, offering that opportunity. For a while, we were taking faculty members to coffee to talk to them. Yes, ma'am.
So during COVID, I used that time and I read every single story, K-5, for the reading curriculum. Mm-hmm. And from that, I created a list. So if you're reading this story in Unit 1, 5th grade, here's a whole bunch of books in my library that are semi-related. Why don't you come check them out? And then I handed those lists to the teachers. And so they can just email me and say, hey, I'm doing Unit 3. can you give me that list? And then they get those books into their classroom as a buffet style for students to choose from. And that was a huge, huge hit. I had one teacher cry. She said, this is so beautiful, I can't believe it.
That's amazing. Yes, anything we can do to make their lives easier, whether that's creating theme lists or things we know that their projects are going to come up so that you can expose the types of things that are related. Excellent. Do we have anybody else who wants to share? I know we're coming up on time. Yes, ma'am.
I would just say from a district level perspective, don't wait until the end of the year to tell your story. Take as many opportunities as you can throughout the school year to tell your story to your administrator, your principals, your instructional coaches, your executive leadership, whoever happens to be in your school. Have those statistics at the ready. Be ready to be able to do your elevator pitch whenever somebody walks into your library. And make sure that your elevator pitch is evolving. Because if every time I walk into your space, I'm hearing the same thing happening every time, that doesn't inspire me to advocate. But if each time I come in, I see a different display, I see different things happening, I see students interacting with adults and all of that kind of stuff, that just makes it so much more powerful and so much easier for me to advocate to people above me, people around me, and it just makes it so much easier. So make sure that you keep your story fresh and evolving, and that you're aware of all the things that are happening in your school building and how your involvement in that instruction is impacting students. Because that's why we do our work, right? So it's like the students are the reason we do everything that we do. It's not the teachers, it's not our administration. It's how are you impacting kiddos? And then be ready to tell that story each time anybody asks. And it needs to be 60 seconds or less.
Right.
Like, keep it short. Be excited, be impactful, because that's what will continue to get your cheerleaders, continue to get those advocates at your building level and at the district level. And that'll make you a rock star in the eyes of somebody, and then they'll bring other people in to see all the good work that you're doing, and all of a sudden now you've got some momentum.
And sometimes,
yeah, definitely. And sometimes the hard part is, and we didn't talk about it, but on the obstacle side was the known interpersonal issues where you know you have that one rock that you're going to come up against, but if they know that you all have the same goal, we're all here for the students. That is, you know, that's our end game, right? We're here to support our students. We may go about it through different means, but if they understand we're on the same team here, this is how I can best do it, or you can best do it, or I can help you do it, or you can help me do it, whatever that conversation is, acknowledging the fact that you may not get along well interpersonally, but professionally, we have the same goal. And being able to talk and do your elevator speech, and all of us at Sam Houston State, every time we interact with, as librarians, we interact with our various departments, we all have an elevator pitch planned. And I won't list how many colleges I work with, because we'll be here a while.
She's our jack of all trades.
I am. But my conversation or my pitch changes just a little bit every time, because I know what their needs are, or I've been watching their curriculum, or I know what their standards are that they have to do. And, you know, if it were a middle school campus, sixth grade social studies. And he was, my sixth grade social studies teacher was one of my cheerleaders. So when I wanted to do something new and innovative, and he was teaching something at the time, and I'm like, we can do that. Let me make sure I have some professional resources for you and some books for the students, and we'll work on developing the lesson together. And when I was a middle school librarian, I also opened and closed all of the novel units for all of my ELIR teachers, because I brought in a new perspective. So how do you figure out what that partnership looks like? And then bank on that, and then have somebody tell your story or help you tell your story.
It's one of the things that's helping, with our READ classes, is that there's this new push to hear different voices. And so we have had more traction from our faculty, our instructors, to let us come introduce a topic, or let them do readings on it first, and then let us introduce the topic, and then go from the discussion from there, right? because they can always guide them back to what they actually want them to know. Right. Go ahead.
Oh, I'll be honest, I don't know how schools work. It's been a while since I've been here, but the last few schools that I've been at, I've been working in the secondary, and they had like department heads or subject area coordinators, and they all had a meeting. And so I advocated and finally got in as to be a part of that meeting, so that I could see it firsthand, which it took like a year and a half to like finally convince them that I needed to be there, but it made such a huge difference because I don't have a department and I can individually go around to each of the departments and talk with them, but it was just too much. So if that's a possibility, or like my elementary counterpart, she did, like the grade level leaders, she'd go in and she'd do the same thing with resources for their particular units where they have them ready.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys so much for thinking with us and sharing with us. We know that our project is not exactly in line, but we hope that we have given you some of the steps that might help your next project get off the ground. I know it's been very impactful for our students to change things up. So, and our contact information is there. If you want to use the QR code, it actually goes to the library guide about this collection. It's not complete yet because, you know, COVID. But we're working on it. And you can see some of the changes Heather has made to the children's collection that we didn't discuss today. She has 27,000 books, and we've made some major changes with that as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.